Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Alice Bryant, and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Monday marked a return to school for thousands of children who lost their homes to a deadly wildfire in Northern California. In Butte County, California, schools have been closed since November 8th, when the wildfire, now known as the Camp Fire, started. It quickly moved through the towns of Paradise, Concow, and Magalia. The Camp Fire was the deadliest wildfire in the United States in a century. It killed at least 88 people. Many others are still listed as missing. The Paradise Unified School District lost 8 schools to the wildfire. District officials were not sure how many of their nearly 3,500 students will report to schools that will temporarily replace those destroyed in the fire. Some families have left California. Others are staying with nearby relatives or friends. It is too far for some of them to drive to one of the temporary schools every day. But nearly all the teachers are returning to provide a calm, familiar face to the children who were able to make it to class. Jody Seaholm's daughter, Mallory, is about to turn 9 years old. In October, Mallory had radiation treatment to remove cancer in her brain and showed no fear, Seaholm told the Associated Press. But this situation, with her house burning down, has absolutely devastated her, she added. It's important that the kids are able to stay together and have some sort of normalcy in the crazy devastation that we're having now, Seaholm said. 2 neighboring school districts have permitted children from Paradise to make use of available space in their school. Children who formerly went to Paradise Elementary School will go to school in nearby Oroville, California. Children from Ponderosa Elementary School will be at a school in Durham. Paradise High School survived the fire. But the school building remains closed because officials have yet to let people return to the area. The district does not yet have space for middle and high school classrooms. So for the 13 days before the start of the traditional winter break in the school year, students will learn through independent study. They will be given homework online and be able to visit a special drop-in center in Chico, California. Children going there can get help from teachers or visit other classmates. Lauren Lighthall, who heads Paradise High School, said studying will likely be less important than dealing with pain and reconnecting with friends. They don't have their school. They don't have their work. They don't have their friends. They don't have any of that stuff, and we're asking them to write essays, Lighthall said. It's just unreasonable at this point. We're going to do it, but we're going to be super flexible with what we require. I'm Brian Lynn.
The 24th United Nations Climate Change Conference is taking place in Katowice, Poland. Delegates have gathered to work on a collective action plan, including on issues like rising sea levels and water temperatures. Since the late 20th century, the world's oceans have experienced the highest warming on record. Oceans also take in about 30% of carbon dioxide emissions from the atmosphere, creating a change in ocean chemistry. The change is killing some sea life and preventing the growth of others. And many coastal communities around the world are facing the effects. One such community is Lisbon, Portugal. For Lisbon, the start of summer marks the celebration of saints of the Roman Catholic Church. Lisbon's most beloved saint is Saint Anthony. He was a Portuguese Catholic clergyman who lived 800 years ago. Each year, Lisbon honors Saint Anthony with a huge 3-day festival and parade. It is the city's largest, happiest, and most colorful celebration. Almost every neighborhood has a street party with music, food, and drink. And everywhere you walk, the air is filled with the smell of grilled sardines. Tradition says that one day Saint Anthony went down to the river and gave a religious sermon to the fish. Hundreds of years later, the people of Lisbon still honor him with sardines, a lot of them. Collectively, the Portuguese eat close to 13 sardines every second during a normal day in June. But as ocean water temperatures rise, sardines are getting harder to catch. A week before the festival in 2018, officials delayed sardine fishing in some waters. They worried about overfishing as rising temperatures have put sardine populations in danger. Just as the next generation of people will pay a high price for climate change, the youngest generation of sardines is at risk. Susana Garrido is a researcher with the Portuguese Oceanic and Atmospheric Institute in Lisbon. She said climate change is putting sardines in special danger as compared with similar fish species. Deep, cold seawater upwelling in waters off Portugal's western coast keeps the coastal waters cool. But small differences in temperature can have a big effect on whether the fish larvae will survive and fully grow, Garrido said. Other researchers have tested how well adult sardines survived in different conditions. But they found little evidence that things such as food availability and water temperature affected the full-grown fish, Garrido said. So, she and her team decided to study sardine larvae. They found that temperature, not the amount of salt in seawater or other things, decided whether or not the larvae would survive. And, she said, A recent count showed that the larval sardine numbers were extremely low. The Portuguese sardine population started to fall about 10 years ago. Around the same time, other fish species slowly moved in. Lisbon's historic Graça neighborhood sits at the highest point in the hilly capital. For the St. Anthony Festival, spaces are set up for music along with several temporary food and drink stands. Luis Diogo Sr., his wife Rita, and their two children, Luis Jr. and Vera, came out to join the party. This is a country between Spain and the sea, so we went to the sea very soon in our history, Luis Sr. said. Luis Jr. did not pay much attention to his father. He was directing his energy to his sardines. I would miss this very much, the 17-year-old said, after eating his third plate of the beloved fish. I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. The most dangerous place for a woman is not a dark street in a strange city. It is not in a war zone or a protest. The most dangerous place for a woman is in her own home. So says a new study from the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime. The study found that intimate partners or family members are responsible for the majority of female killings around the world. The study explains that the majority of murder victims are men, but their killers are usually strangers. Women, the report states, are far more likely to be murdered by someone they know. In 2017, about 87,000 women around the world were murdered. More than half of them, 58%, were killed by intimate partners or family members. 30% of those murders were carried out by current or former lovers. The report found that often these murders are not random. Rather, they are usually the result of past gender-related violence against the victim. When an intimate partner murders a woman, the report states that jealousy and fear of abandonment are among the reasons. However, it adds that women are also killed by fathers, brothers, mothers, sisters, and other family members because of their role and status as women. This kind of killing is often called femicide. In 2017, Asia had the largest overall number at 20,000 of women killed by intimate partners or family members. Africa followed with 19,000, then came the Americas with 8,000 murders, Europe had 3,000, and Oceania had 300. However, based on population, Africa and the Americas are the parts of the world where women are most at risk of this crime. The study found the rate in Africa is 3.1 per 100,000 female population. In 2017, the intimate partner family-related homicide rate was also high in the Americas at 1.6 per 100,000 female population. Europe is the area where the risk is lowest. The study shows that deadly violence against women is on the rise. the UN study experts suggest ways to fight the problem. These include improvements to criminal justice systems and how they deal with violence against women. They suggest that severe punishment for acts of violence against women will help. They call for greater cooperation between police and justice systems, and between health and social services. The experts also claim that men need to be included in the battle against femicide. Educating boys and teens, they say, is an important part of the solution. And that is the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we continue our story of the United States Constitution. In recent weeks, we discussed how the Constitution was written. In the summer of 1787, a group of delegates gathered for a convention in Philadelphia. Their plan was to rewrite the Articles of Confederation. Those articles created a weak union of the 13 states. Instead of rewriting the articles, however, they spent that summer writing a completely new plan of government. On September 17th, after 4 months of often bitter debate, the delegates finally agreed to the new plan. Now they had to get at least 9 of the 13 states to approve it. Delegates to the Philadelphia Convention had met in secret. They wanted to be able to debate proposals and change their minds without worrying about public reaction. Now they were free to speak openly. Each had a copy of the new Constitution. Newspapers also had copies. They published every word. Public reaction was great indeed. Arguments for and against were the same as those voiced by delegates to the convention. The Constitution would save the United States. The Constitution would create a dictator. Yale Law School professor Akhil Reed Amar says the public debate about the Constitution was one of its first successes as a democratic document. He notes that even democracies of long ago, like those in Greece or Italy, did not let citizens vote on their constitutions.
People could be for the Constitution or against it. No one was shut down. No one was put in prison if they liked George Washington or they didn't like George Washington. Just this proliferation, robust, wide open, uninhibited discourse up and down a continent.
Supporters of the new Constitution understood that to win ratification, they needed to speak out. So a few weeks after the document was signed, they began writing statements in support of the proposed Constitution. Their statements appeared first in newspapers in New York. They were called the Federalist Papers. They were published under the name of Publius, but they were really written by three men, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas says he deeply respects the men who wrote the Federalist Papers.
These are people who were engaged, who knew the Constitution. Also want you to know, these were not scholars. These were farmers. These were business people. Some of them who had formal education. Some who did not, but they cared about this country.
Years later,
Historians said the Federalist Papers were the greatest explanation of the Constitution ever written. But in 1787, they had little effect on public opinion. The debate over the Constitution divided Americans into two groups. Those who supported it were known as Federalists. Those who opposed it were known as Anti-Federalists. The Anti-Federalists were not anti-American. They were governors, heroes of the Revolutionary War, and even a future president. Yet they distrusted the idea of a strong central government. Give too much power to the president, Congress, and the courts, they said, and citizens would no longer be free. They would lose the liberties gained in the war for independence from Britain. Law professor Akhil Reed Amar says the Anti-Federalists were an important part of the debate and of history.
The people who oppose the Constitution, who think it could be better still, they're not cast out. They become presidents of the United States, vice presidents of the United States, justices on the Supreme Court. It's extraordinary how they're kept in the process.
There were both Federalists and Anti-Federalists in the Continental Congress. The Congress had few powers, but it was the only central government the 13 states had at that time. It met in New York City. The convention in Philadelphia had sent the Continental Congress a copy of the new Constitution. Within 8 days, the Congress agreed that each state should organize a convention to discuss ratification. One by one, the states held those meetings. Delaware was the first state to ratify early in December 1787. All the delegates voted to approve it. Pennsylvania was the next to ratify, also in December. New Jersey ratified the Constitution in December, followed by Georgia and Connecticut in January. That made 5 states. The Federalists needed just 4 more to win ratification. Massachusetts voted in early February. Delegates to the state convention wanted the Constitution amended to include guarantees to protect citizens' rights. They agreed to ratify if these guarantees were added later. Maryland ratified the Constitution at the end of April. There, a number of delegates included a letter of protest with their vote. They said, if the plan of government were not amended, the liberty and happiness of the people would be threatened. At the end of May, South Carolina became the 8th state to ratify. Just 1 more state, and the new Constitution would become the law of the land. All eyes turned to Virginia. Virginia was the biggest of the 13 states. 1/5 of all the people in America lived in Virginia. The men who attended the ratifying convention were among the most famous names in the nation: James Madison, Patrick Henry, George Mason, James Monroe, Edmund Randolph, and John Marshall. The most famous Virginian, George Washington, stayed at his home, Mount Vernon. All during the month of June, however, riders brought him messages from the convention and carried messages back. Thomas Jefferson was still in Paris serving as America's representative to France, but others kept him informed of everything that happened at home. Jefferson wrote back that he liked most of the Constitution, but he said, I do not like the fact that it does not contain a declaration of the rights of citizens. For 3 weeks, the Virginia delegates argued about the Constitution. By the end of June, they were ready to vote. Patrick Henry, the outspoken anti-federalist, asked to make a final statement. "If this convention approves the Constitution," Henry said, "I will feel that I fought for good reasons and lost the fight. If this happens, I will wait and hope. I will hope that the spirit of the American Revolution is not lost. I will hope that this new plan of government is changed to protect the safety, the liberty, and the happiness of the American people." Then the convention voted. Virginia approved the Constitution. However, like Massachusetts, it added that the document must include a declaration of rights for the nation's people. Federalists in Virginia thought their state was the ninth to ratify, the one that made the Constitution the law of the land. But they soon learned that New Hampshire had ratified a few days earlier. Virginia was number 10. That left three states: North Carolina, Rhode Island, and New York. In a way, New York was the most important of all. If New York refused to join the Union under the Constitution, it would be almost impossible for a central government to rule the nation. The 12 other states would be divided in two, geographically separated by New York State. Alexander Hamilton was a leader of the Federalists. They used their right to filibuster to make many long speeches to delay the vote. They wanted to wait to hear what Virginia would do. Early in July, they got the news. But New York's anti-Federalists kept up the fight for 3 more weeks. It was not until the end of July that New York finally ratified the Constitution. The vote was extremely close, 30-27. Like Massachusetts and Virginia, New York demanded a declaration of rights. The long struggle to give the United States a strong central government was over. It took 4 months to write a new constitution. It took 10 months to ratify it. Yale Law School professor Akhil Reed Amar says adopting the Constitution was, in his words, the most democratic deed in history.
"For the first time ever in the history of the planet, an entire continent got to vote on how they and their posterity would be governed. And there were lots of exclusions, you know, from our perspective, but we wouldn't exist, you know, as a democratic country, as a democratic world, but for that."
The Continental Congress declared that the Constitution would become effective the first Wednesday in March, 1789. The last two states, North Carolina and Rhode Island, did not approve it until many months after that date. Benjamin Rush of Pennsylvania, who had signed the Declaration of Independence, wrote down 8 words when he heard that the Constitution had been ratified. "It is done," he said. "We have become a nation." But before that, the nation's founders had one more question to answer. How would the Constitution guarantee citizens' rights? Delegates at the convention had raised the point many times, and several states made protecting citizens' rights a condition for approving the document.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.